This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese, filling in for Charity Nebbe. It's late fall, and the outside bugs are gone, but some of them like to move inside, and we may help their cause when we purchase holiday plants and Christmas trees. People have even been known to find birds' nests and mice nests in their tree. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa, and also on the program we have our insect and spider guy, extension entomologist Dr. Donald Lewis of Iowa State University. What bugs like to stay inside with us all winter long? We'll be finding out. And even though spring is about 3.5 months away, nothing can stop us from thinking about our 2011 garden. Also on the program today, Richard Giron of Iowa State's Horticulture Department. Richard can handle all of your plant questions. We'll take your phone calls, emails, tweets, and Facebook questions on Hort Day on Talk of Iowa. It begins after the news. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese, filling in today for Charity Nebbe. An insect doesn't have the benefit of body fat, like bears and groundhogs, to survive freezing temperatures and keep internal fluids from turning to ice. Like all ectotherms, insects need a way to cope with fluctuating temperatures in their environment. So how do insects survive the cold winter months? We hope to find out this hour. And if you're bringing in a Christmas tree and holiday plants, might you be offering free shelter to critters like spider mites? It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa, and I welcome back to the program Iowa State University Extension entomologist Dr. Donald Lewis. And later in the hour, horticulturalist Richard Giron will be with us to answer any plant question you might have. You might be thinking ahead to March 21st, 2011, the first day of spring. You can call us with questions at 866-780-9100, email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.com, or tweet us at IPR Talk and follow us this hour on Facebook. Welcome, Dr. Donald Lewis.
Hello, glad to be here.
I was just thinking ahead to spring. It's only 3.5 months off.
I'm looking forward to that shortest day of the year, and that's right. Only, what, 3 weeks away?
That's right.
And then the days will start getting longer, and it'll be easier to go home at the end of the day when it's not already pitch black when you get to your car after work.
Yeah, that's right. It's an important day. You know, speaking with an entomologist in the winter, there isn't quite as much to talk about, but at the same time, the bugs are always with us in one form or another. And is it possible, Donald, to get freeloaders on Christmas trees and holiday plants?
It's possible. It probably was more possible decades ago, I think, when the pioneers went out and just randomly selected a tree from the landscape and hacked it down with an axe and brought it into the sod hut where they lived. Well, that's probably back too far. But the more back when things weren't quite as well managed in our production areas, they probably had more of this. But you are dealing with nature, and nature has a way of being where it wants to be and when it wants to be, and it's not always at our convenience. And so insects are certainly part of the natural world, and they will be out there in the real world. And when you bring a piece of the real world in, whether it's wreath materials or a Christmas tree or other holiday plants that have been outside during the summer, the insects and spider mites could ride with them. So it remains a possibility, but I think the bottom line, and we're probably jumping ahead here, but the bottom line is don't let this ruin your holiday. Don't obsess over this. If it happens, nothing bad will happen to you anyway.
Now, you mentioned that you can bring in a bird's nest or a mouse nest with a Christmas tree. Does that really happen?
Well, I think it could. More likely bird nest than mouse nest. But there could be situations where if you cut at the bottom of the tree, the mice may have created some sort of a little habitat. But it's the real world, and birds and mice live in Christmas tree plantations, which is where most of our cut trees come from. You could find one in the wild and cut that one down if you have permission to do so. But by and large, if you're at a lot picking out a tree, it has come from the real world somewhere, and those critters could have been there. Now, I should say the producers, the people growing our Christmas trees, the people selling them, the greenhouse growers who are producing our holiday plants, they are working very, very hard to make sure this doesn't happen. And we get really good products, and high-quality plants are what we expect, and that's what they produce. And so the chances are very slim. But that doesn't mean it couldn't slip through and happen anyway. So you might find surprises. You might get more than you want with your Christmas tree. Again, the bottom line is don't sweat. It will be all right.
Okay. You guys sort of take it easy in the winter months, you entomologists, because are people, I mean, are they still sending you pictures of bugs they find somewhere, maybe even inside the house?
It still happens. It really tapers off. The peak for us is that May, June, and July period when people are out looking at their plants. There's another huge batch of calls, letters, emails, sent digital photographs occurs sort of in the fall of the year as people are finding the bugs on their fruits and vegetables they're harvesting. The accidental invaders, the spiders, the ladybugs, the box elder bugs are moving in. So there's another busy time for us, but it never goes away. It's interesting that there are still insects that are active. They aren't active outside today at the temperatures we're having, but the caterpillars that infested your bird seed over the summer, that you've now brought your bird seed into the back porch so you can fill the bird feeder, the caterpillars that are in that bird seed are going to be active when the temperatures are warm enough. So you may find insects like that. This is also the time of the year when we do all of our training for next year to remind people of what to look for and so forth. So the insect questions never quite go away, but they slow to a trickle, which is a good thing at this time of year.
Well, here's a question about bagworms. Let's go to Fred, who's calling from Corning. And good morning, Fred.
Good morning. Appreciate your program. Gentlemen, here in southern Iowa, the bagworm population dropped precipitously after last winter's cold weather. But my question is this. If the females don't fly, which I understand, and that's why the population grows on a single tree, how does the population spread when the males are the only ones that fly?
Good question. A couple of possibilities. One is we move them if we bring nursery stock up, but that doesn't explain why they get all the way to Indianola, Des Moines, Ames on those years of successive mild winters. But yes, after a few mild winters, we've had some severe ones, and the population has pretty much moved back to the south, where this insect is a permanent resident. For us, it's sort of a sometime resident. Well, the behavior of spiders and gypsy moth caterpillars and bagworm caterpillars gets the immatures around, and it's a process called ballooning. And it's just like a hot air balloon, except there's no hot air from a cold-blooded insect. But when those eggs hatch in May or June, the little tiny caterpillars that are a quarter of an inch walk to the end of the branch, and they start producing a single strand of silk from the salivary glands of their mouth. And that silk strand just extends out from the body of this little tiny caterpillar. I mean, we're talking less than a quarter of an inch. And when that strand of silk gets 2, 3, 4 feet long, enough updraft will pick that caterpillar and silk up off of the tree branch and carry it aloft with the breezes. Now, tens of thousands may be up there floating in the air, and those that land on the freeway die, and those that land in the pond die, those that land in the cornfields will die. But enough of those caterpillars land on your spruce tree, your cedar trees, your juniper bushes, and those survive. So gypsy moth does that. Some of the spiders do that. But specifically for us, the bagworm does that. And it's the first instar, the tiniest caterpillar, that disperses.
Well, I appreciate knowing that. I've wondered this for years now. And I've seen spiders actually do that. But I didn't realize that the bagworms did it too. So that solves the mystery.
All right. And the bagworm problem will be another mystery next year, whether or not we have a mild enough winter for them to survive. This is a southern insect. It does very well down in Kansas City, Indianapolis, St. Louis, and further south. Does well in central Illinois. But what we learned two winters ago and again one winter ago is that it's a wimp. It does not make it through the Iowa typical winter when we get down into those minus 20 degree temperatures overnight. And it's because the eggs are hanging there in the bags on the trees through the winter. And if the eggs don't make it, There are no caterpillars the following spring.
Well, I happen to be one of these Christmas tree farmers, so I have quite a few spruces. And I know last year I worked very hard to control them, and this year it was much easier because they basically were all dead.
That's right. Winter took care of them for you.
Right. Thank you very much, Joe.
Thank you, Fred, for the call. That was very interesting. I learned a lot about bagworms.
Bagworms and ballooning. It's, if the female can't get around, there has to be some dispersal mechanism, and that has been invested into those little tiny first instar caterpillars to spread out.
866-780-9100. That is the number to talk to Dr. Donald Lewis, extension entomologist. Notice I didn't call you an etymologist.
Well,
we have another program on that topic from time to time.
That's right, and I'm kind of a fan of the derivation of names of insects.
Oh, are you really?
So that I guess that makes me an entomological etymologist.
That's very interesting. Email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Donald, what is the fascination of insects? You've been studying insects for a long time.
A lifetime.
And I find them really interesting, although a lot of them I find just sort of gross. But you must really, truly appreciate them for what they are.
Yes, and it wasn't anything I planned. I wasn't one of those geeky insect collecting, butterfly net waving children. It happened in college for me that I grew up, I was going to be a dairy farmer, and that's what I intended to be when I went away to college. But my first general biology course was taught by an entomologist. And suddenly, biology, which I had pretty much tolerated with a permanent sneer on my face through high school, became interesting to me, and it was because of him, the teacher. Dr. Tom Woods was, and I don't remember many of my college instructors, but he was an entomologist, and he made biology so interesting that I dropped dairy science as a major and became a biology major and went on to graduate school in entomology. I think what keeps me interested in entomology is always learning something new. There are always new and different insects. There are different things being developed or determined about insects. But I think what really keeps me interested in it is the people's reactions and other people's interest in insects and what they want to know. Questions like Fred, you know, here's this little piece of biology that was interesting to him, and that makes it interesting to me when people want and need that kind of information.
Robert and Linda Scarth, who were on the program yesterday with Charity on their beautiful book of Photographs of Iowa Nature, had a number of interesting photos of insects. And they're so beautiful and so colorful. You don't notice the colors, I think, until you can really get focused in close.
It's a trick to take those good close-up photographs, and I always admire the people who have that skill.
We'll take a break for about 2 minutes and be back on Talk of Iowa. Donald Lewis, extension entomologist. Richard Geron will join us, too, coming up next as Horticulture Day continues in just a couple of minutes here on Iowa Public Radio. 866-780-9100, phone number. Send us an email at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Talk of Iowa continues here on Iowa Public Radio on this Friday morning. I'm Dennis Reese, filling in today for Charity Nebbe, and guests today on Horticulture Hour, Donald Lewis and Richard Geron. And before we get to Richard, Dr. Lewis, we have a call. I want to take a call from Harry, who's calling in from Des Moines. Good morning, Harry.
Yes, hello.
Hello, what's your question?
Well, I'm a vegetable gardener, and for about 25 years I've been fighting a losing battle with cucumber beetles. Someone told me last year that if I would saturate the soil with one part of bleach and 9 parts of water before planting my cucumbers, that I wouldn't have beetles. Now, this past summer, I didn't have beetles. I had an enormous crop of cucumbers, the best I've ever had in 50 years of gardening. And I'm wondering, was it the bleach or was it the winter?
It was the winter and probably a dozen other random variables that we don't have a good understanding of. We do lots of research on cucumber beetles out at the Iowa State University Horticulture Station. It's one of the ongoing projects. And one of the disappointments as a researcher is that some years we don't get enough beetles, and other years we have way more. So One of the things that we can say happens without a doubt is the populations go up and down from year to year. One of the things that we should probably embroider on a pillow and sell at the store, bleach is never an insecticide. Unless you can drop the bottle of bleach directly on the insect, bleach is not going to kill insects. So bleach is a mild fungicide. It might be a bactericide. It might help with a few other of the pathogenic things, but bleach is not an insecticide. And I have to keep telling this to people who want to bleach their cupboards to kill the beetles that are in the stored food. They want to bleach their drains to clean, to kill the flies that might be breeding down in the slime of the drain. People have great faith in bleach, and it's misplaced. Bleach is not an insecticide. So keep the battle with the cucumber beetles, but either use insecticides. If you plant late, you have less chance of beetles transmitting the wilt bacterium that diminishes your production. But you have to plant in June, and a lot of gardeners just don't want to wait that long to put out their cucurbits. But the bleach didn't solve it.
I'll try that also. And if you ever run short of beetles, just give me a call. I usually have plenty.
You have plenty. Well, it's good to know. And you mostly you have the striped one, or do you have the spotted ones? Or do you have both?
I have some of each.
Yep. Most people do. It's the striped one that seems to be a little more destructive. And they spend the winter in the adult beetle stage. Dennis was talking earlier about insects surviving our cold winters. Those cucumber beetles that developed last summer, 2 or 3 months ago, have gone into hibernation in the tall grass and the fence rows. And when it warms up in the springtime, they will climb up on top of the fence posts and start looking around to see where you have planted the cucumbers and the melons, and they'll be right over for their springtime snack.
Okay. Well, they are interesting little creatures, and I appreciate your comments.
All right. Anybody who needs some beetles, just call Harry there in Des Moines. I'll take care of you. Hello, Richard Geron.
Good morning.
How are you?
Great.
Well, it's you know, it's almost winter, and so, but we have some things we'll talk about. And we have a tweet in from Nolan. He says, is there an easy resource for tree cloning or grafting? I don't want to attempt it on my own and mess up.
I would probably go to maybe the library and look for a book on plant propagation. Typically, they'll have one. There's a lot of ways to propagate plants, cuttings and seeds, and also on grafting and budding. And hopefully, they'll have some good diagrams or photographs and show you how to do it. You could do that online, too, possibly, going to Google. But try to find a reputable source, like a university source. And some grafting methods are fairly easy.
But propagation is sort of the technical term that the scientists use.
Right.
Yeah. So propagation is a key word here, and it's lots of library searches and internet searches require you to know the lingo before you start.
So when you buy, for example, like a fruit tree or a shade tree, most of those trees have been produced by budding or grafting. That's the only way that they can ensure that you're getting exactly the plant that you wanted. If they grow it from seed, it's going to be genetically different. So typically your fruit trees, your shade trees, they're all produced by grafting because they really can't do it by cuttings. Most trees don't root very well from cuttings, so they basically graft them or bud them.
Okay, great. Appreciate that question. You know, I want to go back to Donald for a second. We had a staffer here talking to me yesterday. I won't mention the person's name, just out of embarrassment because of some insects inside. But, you know, centipedes, I've always had a special disgust for them for some reason. My poor father always used to go around the house hitting them with, you know, newspapers and stuff. But they do tend to hang around even in the winter months. Is there anything we can do to get rid of those of centipedes?
Well, the house centipede is a year-round resident. They are always in the house. We may find them outside in the summer months, and they probably are hibernating, those that made it to the adult stage outside. But house centipede is always with us. And the thing about house centipedes is they grow, develop, spend a year or more in the small, dark recesses of the house and defined as those places hardest for you to reach. And if we were going to use an insecticide to try to control house centipedes, we would be trying to put it in the hardest to get to places, behind the stored box, behind the shelf in the basement, under the water heater, under the furnace, behind the washing machine. All those places that are almost impossible to get to are where the centipedes are going to live and grow. Yeah. So maybe rather than loathe them, which is the usual reaction, mm-hmm. I at least jump when I see one. And maybe it's those long legs. Maybe it's the fast movement. It's the unexpectedness of them. I also jump when I see garter snakes, and I know they're not going to hurt me. Centipedes are not going to hurt me.
They're really not going to hurt you, right?
They can't bite. They don't sting. They don't carry diseases. They don't attack your house, the structure, its contents. They are beneficial. Try selling this to the general public, that those creepy things that with 30 of those long thread-like legs are beneficial because they eat other arthropods. They are eating the spiders and the ants that are accumulating under your water heater. So they are doing you a service. They are doing you a benefit, but that's an awfully tough sell. And it's really hard to get rid of them because they spend so much time hiding in those places. Yeah. It's not till they're fully grown that we generally see them out on the countertop, out climbing on the wall. And at that point, the rolled up newspaper, the bottom of your slipper is probably the best thing to use. I'm not sure if a closed up Kindle is going to work as well as a rolled up newspaper.
But No.
We need newspapers just for that purpose.
The staffer who I was talking about also, I couldn't think of the name of this beetle she was talking about. It's called the assassin. Let me get this. The assassin bug.
Uh-huh.
And she said that she's had a few of these, and they're just really sort of scary. I guess they can almost fly. Do you know what I'm talking about here?
Assassin bug is a whole family of insects, and there are several that are moderately common around the house. But yes, in the adult stage, they are like stink bugs, box elder bugs, squash bugs. They do have wings. They do fly. Assassin bugs are also beneficial. They do not have any impact on us under normal circumstances. They assassinate other insects by poking them with their blunt little beak and sucking their fluids out of the body. So they feed on other insects, and there are assassin bugs that are moderately common outside that we like to encourage because they feed on garden pests like the potato beetle larvae and so forth. Assassin bugs in the house are usually accidental invaders that have wandered in and really aren't that big of an issue for us. But if you think long, flat insects are creepy, this one would fit the bill as well.
866-780-9100. Give us a call with your horticulture question or your insect or spider questions here on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Our email is talkofiowa, one word, at iowapublicradio.org. Donald, as I was saying, my father, who is afraid of nothing, would see one of these centipedes, you know, just skirt across the carpet, and he would just sort of freak out. He was so scared of them. I don't like them much either, but anyway.
I think that's typical.
Yeah, I think so. Let's go to Richard. Richard, I was reading about winter vegetable gardens and on the internet, and they sound very interesting. But I wanted to ask you if it's even possible to have a winter vegetable garden in this climate.
Not really in most respects. Now, you could have maybe underneath some artificial lighting. You might have some things like lettuce and spinach. And so you might have a few herbs, you might have maybe some lettuce and spinach, and you might be able to grow a few of those. But as far as things like tomatoes and peppers and eggplants and cucumbers, you really can't. So basically it's limited to things like your cool season leafy crops like lettuce and spinach and maybe a few herbs.
Can we still have anything in the garden, those underground roots that we left for storage out in the garden?
We still might have things, for example, like parsnips or possibly horseradish. Now, if the ground is not frozen, we could still dig those up and harvest those. But that's going to have to be done soon because I'm afraid it's going to get very cold the next few days.
Yeah, it certainly is. Temperatures single digits. What about bulbs that one might receive as a Christmas gift?
Well, the one that you might get would be the amaryllis bulb.
Amaryllis, right.
And you just force that inside. You do need a nice pot. You need some potting soil. And you basically pot it up. And when you pot it up, the actual bulb, about half of it should stick above the potting soil. You water it in nicely. Then you keep it moist. And then you wait for it to grow. It may be a few weeks. It may be 3 or 4 weeks. But eventually it grows and blooms indoors.
Is it too late to plant the tulips that I didn't get done?
Boy, if you don't get it done soon, I'm afraid the ground's going to be frozen. And you really cannot store those until spring. So if you have some, if you have some tulips, daffodil bulbs that you haven't gotten in the ground, do that immediately. Because if you can't, the ground's going to freeze and then they're basically going to basically die.
Look at this. We have a question about centipedes from Allie. I knew somebody would call in about centipedes in the Quad Cities. Hello, Allie.
Hi, actually it's in Des Moines, but nonetheless my question's on centipedes. And I tuned in halfway into the program and I heard you describe these lovely animals called centipedes, which are very different than what I was used to when living in the Virgin Islands. We had them 9 inches long, very unfriendly. When they sting you, they really hurt like heck. So are these two related, or are they the ones that we have in Iowa, something else that we just refer to as a centipede?
Well, they're related, like saying a toucan is related to a robin. They are, so there's, you know, you've got a tropical, huge, colorful, much different than our upper Midwest version of something in that same group.
We don't have those here.
No, we do not have the biting size centipedes, but certainly in Latin America, Caribbean areas, Mexico, South America, there are centipedes that are large enough that have jaws big enough to bite.
And they sting very hard.
They're biting you with their fangs, but injecting a venom. So it feels like a sting, but it's done from the other end with their feeding apparatus. I've heard it described as a wasp sting or a bee sting. Was that your experience?
Luckily I haven't been stung by a wasp, but I can just say it's not a very pleasant feeling to have, and it's very hurtful. But thanks for clearing it up.
Right. So the bottom line, though, is if you live in Iowa and have a 1-inch long centipede in your house, it is not going to bite you or hurt you.
Okay.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks for that call, Ollie, from Des Moines. Let's go to Ari now, who is in the Quad Cities. Hello, Ari.
Hi there. How are you?
What's your question?
Well, in the past few years, I've been seeing more and more documentaries about the harmful effects of pesticides, insecticides, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the big companies that everybody seems to mention is Monsanto. And, you know, they talk about the harmful effects of these pesticides and whatever else in India, Mexico, and the United States. So I was kind of wondering about the candidate's position on Monsanto products and the alternatives to such.
We have lots of alternatives, and integrated pest management, the concept that we teach through Iowa State University and Iowa State University Extension, is 52 years old. We had our golden anniversary of the concept of integrated pest management just a few years ago, which said we purposefully go through a series of steps to reduce the amount of insecticide or the amount of herbicide that we're going to need by taking the other actions that get us to that point. Earlier, I was talking to Harry about his cucumber beetles and mentioned planting late as an alternative to having to spray cucumbers to control beetles earlier in the season. So this has been our philosophy for as long as I've been at Iowa State University, that what can we do to reduce the amount of pesticide that we use? Having said that, though, there are times when pesticide is the appropriate tool to use. And no matter what your job is, you've got a choice of tools and you pick the right tool for that job. And so sometimes a pesticide would be the right tool to use, but still we use it as sparingly and as judiciously as possible. Corporations.
Yeah, I meant more so the alternatives to the Monsanto products, because that seems to be an issue of contention. in these documentaries among experts is there's got to be alternatives to whatever kind of spray they're using.
Lots of companies are in the pesticide manufacturing business, but due to consolidations and buyouts over the last 50 years, it's gotten down to there are a few big ones left. And multinational conglomerates are an easy target. Monsanto makes a lot of different products, not just pesticides. Bayer, Dow Chemical, you know, these are the big players that are still in the pesticide business. But as far as small startups creating an alternative, sure, we have those as well. Sometimes they are regional products, and sometimes we have they have limited distribution, whereas a huge corporation is marketing over a much wider area. Products are easier to find. But in the sustainable agriculture, in the sustainable horticulture industries, we find more and more use of these local products or alternatives to pesticides altogether.
Okay, Ari, thanks a lot for the call. We'll take a break for about 2 minutes and be back as Horticulture Friday continues here on Iowa Public Radio. Donald Lewis, extension entomologist Richard Giron, professor of horticulture at Iowa State University. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. Email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Back in a couple of minutes. Talk of Iowa continues on this Friday. It's the 3rd of December. I'm Dennis Reese for Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. Donald Lewis, Richard Giron with me on the program today. Our toll-free line to call in with your questions, 866-780-9100. And as a special extra today, we're taking your insect and bug and spider questions as well because Dr. Donald Lewis is with us. Let's go to Scott, who's calling from West Chester. Hello, Scott.
Hello. How are you doing this morning?
Good. What do you want to talk about?
Well, my question is pertaining to toads. I do construction, and if I'm ever at a job site and I see a toad, a lot of times I'll take it home and put it on my property just for to eat flies and mosquitoes and so on and so forth. And I didn't know if I could overpopulate my acreage or if that somehow environmentally would be bad.
No, I don't think you're going by catching and releasing toads. I don't think you're going to screw up the environment. I don't think we're transmitting diseases that aren't already in the environment. You might not want to bring any of those bufo toads from Hawaii home in your suitcase. You don't want to be bringing things across the state lines. But my experience with toads is I've also tried to introduce them to my property. And unless you have a good, moist environment, toads tend to dwindle. And it was 20 years ago I was talking about toads and somebody gave me a bucket full of toads and I scattered them around the yard. And by the following year, I couldn't find a one of them. So I felt like pretty much a failure at toad introduction.
Sure.
Toads don't, yes, they're beneficial. They probably don't help up in the air as much as they eat things that are closer to the ground and some feeding on other things besides the high-flying insects, mosquitoes and flies. So if you're successful at introducing them, you must have the right environment. And if the environment's not right, they don't survive, is my experience.
Well, I've noticed that the population has increased, and I not necessarily for just the toads, but I try to supply, you know, so to speak, a decent habitat for them.
Yeah. No, I think this is a commendable thing that and I think you're right to think it's not as easy as buying toads and introducing them. And as this goes for people who think life will be simple if they just buy lady beetles and release them, or if they buy a praying mantis egg case, suddenly the quality of life will improve and their children will get better grades in school or something. It just, you know, there are no simple answers, and your habitat-wide view of the environment is the way to go, that you do with these things you can. You leave some tall grass, you leave high grasses in the winter, you put in ponds, and you have this diversity of plants and habitats, and life improves.
Well, I appreciate your time, and I won't hold you up anymore.
Thanks a lot, Scott. I'm glad you take care of the toads. That's wonderful. Appreciate
Thanks
the call.
Much.
What do the toads do all winter?
Well, gee, I think you'll have a wildlife program coming up
soon.
Yeah,
that's probably true. Yeah, that's I shouldn't be asking you.
You might want to ask the wildlife specialist.
Yeah, we're not sure.
But I think they burrow down and they have to hunker over and make it through the winter. How many toads do you have in your yard, Richard?
I haven't seen one recently, so I don't know.
You know, I think this year I had more than usual because of the moisture levels and so forth that I would see one occasionally. But if you're mowing your grass at 2 inches tall and if you have a manicured lawn, you won't get to see many toads. You have to go a little more natural, a little more rugged than the manicured lawn to keep the toads happy.
Okay. Now I know why I'm not manicuring my lawn. I want to keep the toads happy.
Well, it's like butterfly gardening. People say, well, what can I do to encourage butterflies to be in my garden? And, of course, the first thing we always say is biodiversity. You must diversify your plantings. You have to have different things in bloom at different times. You have to have lots of different species. You can't have just a sweep of one kind of plant. You have to have this whole mixture going on. And calling yourself a butterfly garden is a reason for untidiness. Because you need some weeds for caterpillars. You need some weeds for nectar sources. And saying you are a toad-friendly environment would be another reason for untidiness.
I love it. Let's go to Ben in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Ben.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about box elder bugs.
Okay.
They come in towards the house in the fall, late fall, especially on a warm day in the fall. And I'm wondering how they survive the winter without freezing solid, because I'll go out on a below-zero night in the winter, and they're attached to the outside of the house or trying to get into some kind of crevice or something. And then if you push them down and watch them, they're actually still alive. You take them inside, they warm up, and they feel fine. I don't understand how they don't freeze.
With all of our insects that are adapted to our climate, they have an antifreeze-like material that will prevent the formation of ice inside their bodies, and that's all they have to do. They will be below freezing. If it's minus 20 degrees outside, the insect's body will be close to that temperature of minus 20 degrees, but the glycerol and the other antifreeze compounds in their cells allow them to hibernate without ice forming. Now, if you took a summer insect and put it in your freezer, ice would form in their cells and they would die. But insects that are alive in Iowa in the fall, as the day lengths are getting shorter and shorter and shorter, and as temperatures are changing, those insects will adjust and begin producing these antifreeze compounds that allow them then to survive. We were talking about bagworms at the beginning of the hour as a southern insect. They are less able to produce those ice-preventing materials in the egg stage, and if we get a cold winter in Iowa, they do freeze to death. But insects like box elder bugs and corn borers and Japanese beetles and all those things that are around here and doing well in this climate have this ability to make it through the winter. Now, you mentioned box elder bugs in the house. Those do not survive because they waste the stored energy that was supposed to get them through winter so they could reproduce in the spring. And if they're crawling around in your house, they are burning up reserves, they are draining their battery, and they're not going to have energy to reproduce in the spring. They're going to die prematurely. It's to the box elder bug's benefit to remain outdoors and to stay cold through the winter.
So if they're in my house, if they've been in my house and I put them outside on a sub-zero night, they'll freeze? Or are they still, because they haven't been manufactured?
It's a 50-50 chance. They may, even if they don't freeze immediately, because they have drained their battery over the last few weeks of walking around inside your house or crawling inside your wall voids, they probably are going to die earlier than they would have if they had stayed outside. It may not be as instantaneous as it went below zero and therefore they died. It's likely a combination of things.
Uh-huh. That's very interesting. Thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot for that call, Ben. We have an email from Tom, and Tom says, what temperature do we need if there is no snow on the ground to kill off many of the mosquitoes and other insects over the winter?
Well, follows on with Ben's question that how do insects survive the winter, and the insects that are native here, the insects that survive and prosper here, are going to make it through the winter. Now, mosquitoes, is a that's a mixed bag, because some mosquitoes have laid eggs at the water's edge in the fall, and those eggs have all the materials they need to make it through the winter and to hatch next year with the spring floods. Those floodwater mosquitoes are going to survive no matter how cold it gets outside, or under normal circumstances, let's say. Some mosquitoes make it through the winter as the adult stage, and they are in hibernation, and they are probably concealed under the loose bark of a dead tree. They're not out there on the bare ground, so snow is not going to make much difference to them. Other insects, I mentioned Japanese beetles, they are grubs down in the soil. They have gone 4 to 6 inches deep. Even though frost may reach down that low, they are going to be protected. And actually, an open winter with no snow and deep frost line would probably be more harmful to them. But the thing is, it doesn't matter if you kill 50% of an insect population. It doesn't matter if you kill 98% of an insect population. There will be some survivors. They will start up again in the spring. They will reproduce like crazy, and the insects will be back. It's foolhardy to bet against the insects. They are going to survive.
Okay. Richard, here's an email that you'll be happy to answer, I'm sure, from Annie in Iowa City. Are there any bulbs other than paper white, whites and amaryllis that can be forced indoors without a cooling period?
Those are about the only two. You can force tulips, daffodils, hyacinths indoors, but you have to cool those for 12 to 16 weeks. So the amaryllis and the paper whites are about the only two that you'll find.
Okay, let's go to one more email before we go back to the phone. Here's an email from Pam in Des Moines. I have small spiders that grow around my nightlight in my basement, along with spiders who live everywhere else. What can be done over winter to prevent the rebirth of spiders this spring?
I think the vacuum cleaner is our best indoor spider control. It's going to be more effective than insect sprays, because spiders aren't insects. It's going to be more effective than dusts. It's certainly more effective than just wishing and hoping they don't make it through the winter. But the vacuum cleaner, where you're cleaning up their webs, you're sucking up the surviving spiders, and you're sucking up their eggs, I think that's the thing to do. And as frequently as you can put the long nozzle extension on your shop vac or the hose of your vacuum cleaner, as frequently as you can go around and suck up cobwebs, spider webs, and spiders and their eggs, the better off you will be. I think that's the best I can suggest for spider control. I don't know if that has to be monthly or quarterly, but as frequently as you can bring yourself to sucking up the webs, I think that's your best choice.
866-780-9100, Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio News. Donald Lewis, Richard Geron, Horticulture Day. Let's go to Ken, who is calling in from Bluegrass. Good morning, Ken.
Hi. Say, a few years ago, I lost a bunch of trees in my yard to wind, and I'm wanting to replace some trees, and I don't want to plant ash, worried about the bugs. Does the Kentucky coffee tree, I've seen some of those, are they have any problem with insects or disease?
Now, when you choose any tree, potentially can have insect or disease problems. Nothing is pest-free completely. But the Kentucky coffee tree is a nice tree. If you go with that tree, I would choose a male cultivar. The females do produce a fairly large pod that can be kind of a maintenance headache. So I would go with a male cultivar. As far as other possibilities, I would look at oaks, maples, lindens, honey locust, hackberry, and I would look for a diversity. So if you already have, let's say, several maples, then I would look at maybe oaks and other trees. So you have kind of a diversity.
If I grow a Kentucky coffee tree from seed, though, how long do I have to sell my property before I know if it's a female?
Probably 10 or 15 years.
Okay, that's good, because I did. I grew a Kentucky coffee tree from seed, and okay, so I have to sell within the next 10 years. Thanks.
Right.
For
So when you grow anything from seed, whether it's a ginkgo or the Kentucky coffee tree, it's going to have to grow and mature before it's able to go ahead and produce fruit. So it may be 10 or 15 years. In the case of a ginkgo, it could be maybe 20, 25 years before you really know. So the fortunate thing is, as far as ginkgos and the Kentucky coffee tree and those other trees that have, let's say, nuisance-type fruit, you can buy male cultivars that don't produce them.
These trees really produce coffee beans?
Actually, apparently, according to the myth, I guess.
The legends,
is that the early settlers didn't have true coffee, and they would take these pods, and inside the pods, they have these rather large gray seeds, and they would actually grind those up and use those as a coffee substitute. That's the legend behind it. It's actually a legume. Belongs to the bean family, but so is the honey locust.
Couldn't taste any worse than chock full of nuts, I don't think. Ken, did that answer your question?
It sure did. I'm going to try to find a grower that has one already and then and have them transplant one so I don't have to wait the 15 or 20 years. I've got a ginkgo now already that's about 30 years, and I'm lucky with that one, it seems. I don't have the pods. So, hey, thank you very much. Enjoy your show.
Okay, thank you, Ken. Let's go to Doug now in West Des Moines. Hello, Doug.
Hey, good morning.
What's your question?
I enjoy the show very much.
Thank you.
I just had a quick question. What is ahead for the insect population in Iowa with global warming?
Oh, we will see some things we haven't seen before. I don't think we're going to lose very many things, but climate change is bringing us these radically fluctuating conditions. And you think about the floods that we had, we think about floods from last year in 2008 in Cedar Rapids, and you think about the flooding and how that increases mosquito populations in the short run. So some things will be up because of that. 5 years ago, I thought maybe climate change had brought us the bagworm from Kansas City, that it was now going to survive in Ames, Iowa. But no, we went back to some normal winter temperatures, and they moved back to the south. So it may be a long time before we have a clear picture, but should I be buying some wisterias and southern plants and putting them in my yard because of expected global change? What do you think, Richard?
Not quite yet.
Not yet.
Not yet.
So
this is Iowa, and the one thing about Iowa is the weather is always unpredictable. So,
and as the fluctuations get larger, maybe things will change for the brief period, but it'll be a while before we see any long-term population changes.
About things like rodents and snakes and that kind of thing.
Oh, I suppose there are some southern species that might move a little farther north and survive here better than they do now. Dennis, when is the next wildlife show scheduled?
It's coming up next week, actually, next Tuesday, I believe.
Okay, so call in again and ask about global climate change effects on wildlife when when the animal ecologist is here.
All right, thanks.
Okay, thank you, Doug. I wish we had time for more calls, but we're just about out of time. I want to thank both of you for being on the program today, Dr. Donald Lewis, extension entomologist, Dr. Richard Geron, professor of horticulture. Thanks, guys, so very much.
Thank you.
Talk of Iowa is our executive producer today is Jeff Schmidt. We had assistance on Talk of Iowa from Lindsay Moon in Iowa City and Russell Mansky from Ames. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Charity Nebbe will be back on Monday. I'm Dennis Reese. Thanks for tuning in. Have a great day.